Up in the view on your top right, if you
Oh,
see, you can
that.
go down.
Oh. Okay. Not sure if I can figure that out, but that's okay for the moment. Hello, everyone. It's lovely to see some of you. And welcome to this session. Thank you very much for having me. So my work, as Marnie said, is around supporting people creating systemic change or supporting others who are at the sharp end of unfair systems, whether that's political, social, ecological arenas. I work individually with people as a coach or a mentor, and also with organizations like charities or campaigning groups. And here I am today doing some Dharma teaching, so that's also part of my world. And if any of that kind of appeals to you and you'd like to stay in touch, you can do so. I'm just putting my links in the chat. And I always like to hear from people about their ideas and what they're doing in this intersection of practice and action in the world. And one of the reasons I really love hearing from people is that I used to feel a little bit alone, kind of at this intersection. But more recently, I've been finding more and more people who also hang out here. Sometimes they're meditators who are taking steps towards more engagement with the world. And sometimes they're people very involved in changing outer systems who also start getting curious about inner systems. And maybe some of them are you. Either way, they are people who wish to respond to suffering practically, meaningfully in their inner lives, but in other dimensions too. And these dimensions can include that inner world, responding to suffering in terms of our own emotions, our own ideas. Our experiences can include the interpersonal world, direct relationship interactions with others. It can also include our relationship with the earth, with nature, and our relationships with the patterns of social and economic power we see around us, social groups and structures and so on. So I see this as a kind of like an onion model with the inner, interpersonal, social, political, and then ecological. And in all of these aspects, there's the possibility for greater freedom for ourselves and others. I showed this model to Martin once, and his response was suitably cosmic. He said, "Wait a minute, where's the universe?" And then we couldn't decide whether does the universe go outside or inside. Like, is it the at the which extreme is it? And maybe it's both. Anyway. I like to think of myself as someone who provides a bit of a slippery slope between these worlds, inner and outer change, a bit of a connector. So, as I was saying before, could sometimes feel a bit strange, like a bit of maybe the unusual person before, but things are really changing. And because even the Buddha, he was politically engaged. He advised kings, he mediated between warring tribes, he had views on social affairs, economic affairs. And ever since, there have always been people who share their ideas or show in their lives how to integrate inner and outer practice, how both are sites for liberation. And some of these people show up Sangha Live. Sometimes I meet them when I'm out and about. I was at a protest recently. I counted about six different Buddhist practitioners that I knew. I was at a political festival last weekend, and I got approached by people who'd met me on Sangha Live. Some people have written books, some people have started organizations. Even if they're not alive anymore, we can learn about their stories. And the more of these people that I've learned about, or met, or read about, or seen their work, the more I've realized that they are our spiritual ancestors. They're the nodes in our Indra's web of practice. They connect to us, they provide us with context, and they also connect with each other. And because I've gained so much, I guess, reassurance as well as inspiration from meeting them, learning about them, I like to share their stories as well. So that's what today is all about. I'm going to share some kind of story portraits of some of these contemplative activists. And my hope is that this will be a way for me to extend this sense of community, of inspiration, and of reassurance to include you. And maybe you can include others in the future. So we'll share some quiet practice together in a minute. Then I'll share some of these stories. Then we'll have some time for questions and discussions. But before we sit together, I'd like to invite you to have some personal reflection and maybe grab a pen and paper or your device. And I invite you to reflect what drew you to this session. What is it that called out to you, made you want to attend today? And also, do you have a question or a challenge in this kind of area or that is linked to these topics? So, what drew you to this session today, and do you have a particular question? I'll give you some quiet time for that now, and just feel free to make some notes for yourself. Put the questions in the chat. And then in a couple of minutes, we'll settle in for some meditation together. Another half a minute. And if you wish, you're very welcome to share any of your reflections in the chat. There's no obligation to do this. I may or may not be able to address them directly. I might address them indirectly, or you may find that what you share has resonance for others, which is always reassuring. So feel free to share some bits in the chat, and we'll now set up for some quiet practice. We'll sit together for about half an hour. So feel free to find your way to settling in your body the best way you know. You might wish to stretch a little or shift around. In some way, find your balance, your way to settle physically. Maybe taking a couple of slightly deeper than usual breaths. Maybe shifting around a little bit in your seat, exploring what position might feel settled and grounded and solid for you. When you find that place, allowing yourself to be heavy, allowing your weight to fall down through your body, connect with the support, the chair or the floor or wherever you are. Allowing your hands to be heavy wherever they're resting. Just seeing if you can trust the support of your chair, wherever you're resting. See if you can trust that support, maybe 5% more. What would it be like to just release a little bit into the support of the earth? And as we settle, inviting some gratitude. Gratitude for the Buddha, awakeness, all the people that we know who are examples of awakeness, Buddha in our lives, bringing them to mind. Gratitude for the Dharma, the teachings. Teachings in the Buddhist tradition and elsewhere, things we have found useful in our paths. Gratitude for the teachings, bringing them to mind. And gratitude for the Sangha, the community, whether that's here, other practice Sanghas, other groups we're part of, whether that's through work or activism or family, other groups. Communities that help us find a meaning and find support. Thank you for Sangha. Bringing our Sanghas to mind. And also gratitude for our teachers. From all parts of our lives. Bringing to mind our important teachers with gratitude. And finally, all our other spiritual ancestors and ideas ancestors, people whose thinking and writing and practice in the world has helped to create a world worth living in, and from whom we can learn and find our way. Gratitude for our spiritual and ideas ancestors. Because of their work, faith, commitment, and practice, we are able to practice today together. Gratitude. Taking up our place in this network, practice, support, and love. We sit together quietly for some time. Just checking in with your physical form. You might wish to notice if there are any areas which are holding or bracing or otherwise working in a way that could be released. Seeing how relaxed you can be while still remaining in your chosen position. What's the least work you can do in your body and still be here, bright and alert in your practice? This idea of relaxing into contact with your experience, rather than concentrating on your experience, relaxing into the contact, embracing what's really going on. Keeping a steady embodied awareness of your experience. And if you'd like an anchor or a focus, perhaps you could use the movement of your body as you breathe. Maybe in your stomach or lower belly. If you'd find that useful. And you can also, of course, practice open awareness. In either case, relaxing into contact with your experience. Raining all steadiness. Training our steady ability to relax into contact, to be alongside, our experience. To embrace what's really going on. No matter how many times we notice and come back, every return is an opportunity for reconnection. Now, as we move towards the close of our practice, recalling our gratitude. To this great web of support and teaching. And extending that gratitude also to ourselves and our fellow practitioners here. Taking in the benefits of this practice. And also sharing them with one another. And with all sentient beings, that all beings may be free in all aspects of their lives, inner relationships, interpersonal lives, social, economic, political lives, in their relationships with the earth and with existence itself. May all beings be free, well, and happy. So, taking a minute to transition from your practice. Feel free to make any movements you like or grab some water or something. As I mentioned before, I'm going to be sharing some of these stories. And I invite you as I go along to see what calls out to you, to notice what inspires you, whether there's anything that you'd like to learn more about, or where any of the sparks might lead you in the future. So just kind of keeping a curiosity about your responses, as well as maybe about some of the things I'm going to share. And I'll try to remember to make some time for some reflective pauses along the way as well. And the chat is there for you. Please use it. It's a wonderful way to be in community. And I have a few different portraits to share, so we'll see how the time goes. And they're a real mix. Some of them are famous. Some of them you may have heard of already. Some of them I don't think are famous, or at least not yet. They're all people who bring together contemplative practice and activism or social political engagement in the world in different ways. And I was thinking earlier, I was thinking, oh, I don't really have a theme. I don't have a kind of thread to tie all these together. But really, that's okay because my intention is to kind of just show, just expose these ideas, and to allow you to make up your minds like what's interesting, what's useful. So if there doesn't appear to be a distinct theme, please forgive me, but I thought that diversity was the most useful thing. All right. So I'm just going to share an image because I'm going to show you pictures of each person as I start, just briefly. So hopefully you can see that. This is Dr. A.T. Ariaratne. And he was born in 1931. He's a Sri Lankan. And he died just last year in his 90s. And he set up what's called the Sarvodaya movement in Sri Lanka. And essentially, it was a kind of rural development process or movement based around work camps or volunteer camps, rather. He was originally a teacher, and he experimentally took a bunch of his students and some and a few te other teachers to this village that was outcast, that was low caste, in Sri Lanka, back in 1958. And they essentially went to listen to the villagers and to see what was needed and then to work together on that. And they called these Shramadana camps. Shramadana means the gift of labor. And after the first project, other villagers started to hear about it and invited them to come, and then others, and then others. And so it kind of built until it was really a national organization. They were able to develop their ideas. And for Dr. Ariaratne, that meant a really explicit application of Buddhist concepts to community building and to local development. So I'll share some of his thinking, because I think it's really interesting, particularly how kind of explicit he was about these links. So, for instance, he used a reframing of the Four Noble Truths as his way into projects. And you may have heard of the Four Noble Truths. They're part of Buddhist teachings. And they are, there is suffering. There is a path to suffering. There is an end to suffering. And there is a path to the end of suffering. So he reframed those as, there is suffering means what is the problem? So, for instance, it's hard to reach the market, so we can't sell our goods. Then the second one, there is a path to suffering. What are the roots of this problem? For instance, there is no good road. Third noble truth, there is an end to suffering. Dr. Ariaratne said, what is the solution? Building a road. And then finally, there is a path to the end of suffering. He said, how do we get there? Work together to build the road. And in fact, one of the mottos of the people who would be part of these camps was, we build the road, and then the road builds us. Which is also a really fantastic expression of interdependence. And how all things influence all things. It's so beautiful. And he also wrote quite a bit about Buddhist economics, what he called Buddhist economics, and the idea of non-violence. So sometimes when we think about violence, we think about interpersonal violence mainly. We might think about political violence or state violence. We think about someone with a gun or someone with a fist or someone with a bomb. But there's this other form of violence called structural violence, which is when the way that work or resources or access to justice or access to healthcare is allocated in unfair ways. You know, people who are poor, who can't pay, people who have the wrong caste or the wrong skin tone. And then these opportunities and access to these resources we all need, like justice, like healthcare, like clean water, and so on, they are given to people who have money or who have the right skin tone or who went to the right school or who were part of the right club at Oxford. And he also talked a lot about replacing the structural violence of the social order with a non-violent spiritual revolution that integrated these sort of the inner and outer work. And I think it's a really useful way to look at nonviolence. It's not just about personal or interpersonal physical violence, but about the violence of these systems, of these norms of capitalist economics. And so he promoted essentially a no poverty, no affluent society, an economically just society. And it may interest some of you to know that Joanna Macy, who was a very wonderful teacher and theorist and a big part of the ecological movement, particularly with work like Active Hope, In her 20s, she spent a year with Sarvadaya, and it hugely influenced her work. And Dr. Ariaratne also made many visits to the US through the Buddhist Peace Fellowship. And he advised Bernie Glassman, founder of the Zen Peacemakers, on some of his early economic development work in New York. So amazing kind of connections. And so I'll end my little portrait of Dr. A.T. with a quote from him. He said, "The realization of the impermanence and interdependence of selves in society and nature entails the deepest respect for all." I'll read that again. I might put it in the chat as well. It's quite a big one. The realization of the impermanence and interdependence of selves in society and nature entails the deepest respect for all. So if we see how we are all interconnected, we must care for everyone, essentially. And it's Dr. A.T. Ariaratne. So that is number one portrait. And I'm just going to move on to number two portrait. And someone's asking for his name. You're going to see his name when I go back and show the slides again. And before I move on, let me see. There he is, Dr. A.T. Ariaratne. And Sarvadaya, the movement that he started, is still going strong. Okie dokes, right. At this rate, I'm not going to get through all the portraits, but let's see how far we get. Next portrait, Katie. So, Katie is an academic, a sociologist, and she's also been a union organizer. And I first met her at a London Insight Day retreat about 10, 15 years ago, something like that. And together with someone else that we met, we started this group called Do Sit, which is a sitting group for people at this intersection, which actually I'm starting up again in London now, if any of you are interested. But Katie, her area of study is the way that unions practice solidarity with each other. So not just within the union, but across between different unions. And particularly, she's interested in international collaboration between dock workers' unions. So she goes around interviewing dock workers and writing about that. So she knows all about the challenges of working with groups and in trying to create systemic change in the systems we ourselves are deeply embedded in. And I saw a note from Shanaz earlier about how that's one of the things that you're interested in. So Katie is also a Dharma practitioner with a strong interest in socially engaged spirituality of all kinds. And alongside her academic work, she offers Buddhist chaplaincy at the university. And she sometimes describes herself as a fly in the ointment. So she'll talk about inner work and personal development when she's in activist circles, and she'll talk about activism when she's in practice circles. She really likes asking difficult questions and offering what she calls respectful resistance. And I really relate to this in terms of my feeling about being like a slippery slope in both directions. She's sort of like a fly in both ointments. That's her goal. But with regard to dock workers, just to give an example of some of the things she's been involved with, you may already know they have a long history of arms resistance, of anti-war resistance, because despite all the illusions of our lives of being on the cloud and one-click ordering and objects magically appearing at our doors, it's all actually underpinned by a lot of physical infrastructure, a lot of people moving things, and a lot of that is on ships. Ships have to dock to load and unload, which makes dock workers have this kind of point of power, particularly around arms embargoes. And there have been successful blocks of arms around the Vietnam War, South African apartheid regime, the war in Yemen. And most recently, since the beginning of the destruction of Gaza, trades unions in Palestine called out for international arms embargoes. And all over Europe, dock workers' unions have responded. There have been blockades in Italy, France, Greece, Sweden, Morocco, just to name a few. And social movements have also responded, whether that's students protesting at the universities or people blockading factories, like here in the UK, where parts are made for weapons. And in all of this context, Katie has done something that I think is really useful and interesting. She's taken her existing expertise and contacts, working with all these international dock workers' unions, and she's used them to respond to the direct requests of the people being affected. Those Palestinian trades unions, they had one request from the international community, and that was arms embargoes. So it's a little bit like with Dr. Aty Ariaratne, it's listening first, an approach of deep respect born out of an appreciation of interdependence. And so her response has been to organize with a new group, which is called Workers in Palestine. And they support trades unions to respond to this Palestinian trade union call for an international arms embargo. They help trade union organizers to get started, basically, by sharing information, providing training, and various toolkits. And they've worked with people all over the world, dock workers, but also doctors, tech workers, arts and culture workers, and even workers in the arms industry itself, unionized arms industry workers, they've managed to make links with. And one thing that I found really interesting about speaking with Katie, as well as this way that she uses her existing contacts and expertise to make change and to support those making change, is how she links taking action with healing and how she talks about solidarity, that is, acting with people alongside them to reach common goals, is an absolute blast and something she hopes everyone gets to experience. She genuinely feels sad for people who like don't get the chance to engage with others on common goals because it's so rewarding. She's like, I hope everyone gets the chance to do it. And so a quote from her before I close her portrait. She says, I do believe that activism can be very healing. Perhaps if you have experienced a lot of trauma on the basis of a particular category, because you're a woman or a queer person, because you're a worker, because you're an immigrant or a person of color, you can engage in activism around that. I think it can be incredibly healing, that sense of community, of solidarity, of not feeling powerless anymore. I mean, that's the really wonderful side of activism. So that is Katie's story. And I'm going to pause now briefly just to allow any reflections, and that can just be internal, or you might want to make some notes. I'm also going to look at the chat just to see what's been going by. So we've got half a minute now, just in quiet. All right. So, next couple of stories. These are two climate activists, actually, that I'll talk about next. Okay, so I'll say goodbye to Katie. And I introduce Joe Michan. Some of you may know, often around. Used to be around London Insight quite a bit and very involved with exile Buddhists and previous to that, Dharma Action on Climate Engagement. And that's him in action. So he's based in Hertfordshire. And as I said, he's now involved with exile Buddhists, Extinction Rebellion Buddhists. But before that, he set up an organization called Dharma Action on Climate Engagement. And I joined him for a few actions, for instance, meditating in protest outside Barclays Bank. He's very into meditation as a form of taking action, like actually using the practice of sitting to sit in the way. And so this his particular target is usually Barclays Bank because of the level of their investments in fossil fuel companies. And one of the things I really appreciated about Joe, or I appreciate about Joe, is the way he makes the process of protest, of taking direct action, into a form of community. I don't know if any of you have ever taken any direct action. I suspect some of you have from some of the comments. But if it usually involves quite a lot of discomfort. You know, that's one of the reasons Dharma practice is such great training for activism. So it's usually out in the open. So you're there to get rained on and you're in public, so you'll get stared at, you might get heckled. And crucially, for someone like me, who's a complete introvert, you're not in your house. You know, if I'm not in my living room already, I'm slightly ill at ease. So, you know, it can be really socially uncomfortable. And you're often with people that you don't know yet, doing something quite, you know, challenging with people you don't yet know well. But Joe has some really great ways of working with this. So when we meet for an action, usually do that in a park or somewhere a little away from the target, he'll bring a bell and he'll start with a short meditation. Then we'll go into pairs, and Joe invites us to share what moves us to take action, you know, what it means to us, which allows us to start building that solidarity, that sense of shared purpose. And also helps us to remain connected to the motivation for taking action, to the anger that so many of us feel at the injustices and misuses of power in the world. And Joe and I spoke quite a lot about anger. Like most contemplative change makers, it's something he's thought about really deeply. And he makes a number of distinctions. One is between anger as an emotion, an inner experience, and the discharge of anger, or the reactive expression of anger, let's say, rather than the responsive expression. Another distinction is between anger as passion and anger as hatred or blame. Anger as passion is anger rooted in what you're trying to protect. It could be your children, could be a river, could be fairness. This is anger from passion, as opposed to anger at a corporation for their harmful actions. And actually, you know, both are important, but he maintains that the passion is what's sustainable in the long term, and it's what is rooted in care and helps bring people together. And that's what those conversations at the start of actions are about. There's remembering what we're fighting for, not only what we're fighting against. He says, if you simply focus on anger and blame, that's the route towards burnout, because you've moved away from the fuel that you need, the passion that you need. And it's a good question I use in dyads. Tell me what moves you to come into activism. It's a very important question that people remember and carry. Why they're doing this connects you with something personal, to my children, for example, as well as the global, the state of the planet. So that is Joe's story. And the next is Chriso, another climate activist. You can't really see Chriso very easily here because she's obscured by a giant ice cream that she built. But Chriso has been a climate activist since reading the 2018 IPCC report, which is the one where the scientific community started using more forthright language. And you know, because about the state that we're in, because it was just no longer morally or scientifically defensible to use soft language because they were worried about scaring people. And she described it as like a total grief response, where she almost couldn't take it in for a couple of weeks and then just crumpled. And she says, in that crumpled mess, I realized, I think, as a mother, it's a bit like you see a car coming towards your child. You just want to throw yourself in front of it. The impulse was so huge. I felt I need to come between this and my child and all our children. So I was looking around. I was just looking left and right, thinking, where is the action? And so this was 2018, early 2019. This is when Extinction Rebellion was coming into being. And the big ask was to do relatively spiky street actions that deliberately risked arrest. And she was involved for a while, and it was a relief to be around others taking it as seriously as her. And she met lots of other parents. And talking to them, some people were feeling that it was this strategy of seeking arrest, regardless of its wisdom or not, which we can have a long conversation about, but not now. She felt that it was narrow and excluded people who were unwilling to, or unable to risk arrest, or people who are maybe just coming into activism for the first time. It was kind of, for the first time you're going on a march and then suddenly people are encouraging you to take risks you're not ready for. So she co-founded Mothers Rise Up, and they do other forms of direct action, usually involving lots of creativity, like a musical outside an insurance company to try and get the attention of the decision makers, with professional dancers and lots of lovely props. And she is actually a professional prop maker, so that's where the giant ice cream comes from. And the Mothers Rise Up website says, making changes in our own lives is important, but it's not enough. We believe the most effective climate action we can take is to use our collective power to demand that governments and corporations act now. And if that sounds appealing to you and you're in the UK, but you're not a parent, don't worry. They have a very broad view of motherhood. I don't have any kids. I've joined some of their actions. They're fine. You don't have to literally be carrying a baby, although usually they are, which is great. And when I spoke with Chrisso a couple of years ago down near Brighton, where she lives, one of the things that she wanted to talk about was how practice can be a support for activism by creating space for all the experiences, the emotions, the grief, the anger, and the resistance itself. And she expressed it really beautifully. She says, I realize that sometimes I really need to just have a really big cry and sob into that pain and let it be, and be aware of it as it's happening and let it express itself, and then sit. And there's so much quiet after that. And it's interesting because I don't feel like an angry person, but I'm quite sort of sharp and quite direct. And I found that actually that is really useful for protest because it's sort of what you need, that sort of drive. And it's an outlet for that. And it's not wrong to be that way. Like to have that sort of resistance, there's room for it. I've realized you can deeply accept that you're resisting. Just completely, totally accept that this does not feel okay and I can't be okay with it, so I'm going to rise up. And I feel that's totally supported by the practice. It maybe takes the edge off where the anger or anxiety can become completely overwhelming. And for me personally, it just means I can hold it together a bit better. So that is Chrisso's story. And I am now torn between sharing another story and opening up for questions because I'm sure there's absolutely loads to talk about. And I have two other stories. I could share one. What shall I do? Tell me what to do, what you would like in the chat while I respond to a couple of brief questions. Somebody said, I'm interested in your London sit. Please sign up on my website. There, you can sign up there. Share another story, please share lol. Great, I'm going to share one more because definitely two more. I would be going over the time, and it would be nice to have one or two questions, I guess, a little bit from you as well. All right, next story. Next and last story. There's Chrisso. Here's Dean. You may have met Dean Donald before. He sometimes teaches on Sangha Live. He's also a lay teacher in the Plum Village tradition. So part of the Thich Nhat Hanh teaching world. In fact, Thich Nhat Hanh was the last story I was going to share, but definitely not time for him. But I figured that's okay because most people can find books about Thich Nhat Hanh. All right. So Dean, he's a lay teacher in the Plum Village tradition, also used to be in the army and a jazz musician. So he's had a very storied life. And he spent the rest of his career working in disability justice. So with and for people who have learning disabilities and autism. And I first met Dean on, I think, a retreat, and I've sat with him a few times. He's run residential units and had other roles in the disability sector. But in the end, he was drawn to founding an organization which is all about empowering people to advocate for themselves. It's called Pathways. It's in the northwest, sort of up near Manchester. And it supports people with learning disabilities and autism to influence health and social care commissioning. So that might sound screamingly boring, But it's really important because it means that the services are then built in a way that's actually helpful, because it's built on the insights and needs of the people affected, not the imagined needs of people who are doing things for them. If you've ever come across anything in the disability justice world, there's a important slogan, which is nothing about us without us. So Dean's organisation provides ways for that. He's also worked as a Buddhist prison chaplain. So he's done lots of different types of really interesting work. Have a sip of water. And one of the things he told me about when I was speaking to him about, the way his practice and his work intersected, he talked about making bells of mindfulness. You know, the way we ring a bell for practice. And in Plum Village, I don't know if you've ever been to Plum Village or sat with any Plum Village people, but they use bells a lot. They ring bells throughout the day, even in the middle of daily activities. And it's an opportunity to pause and take a breath, a few mindful breaths. So the response to the bell becomes entrained, just like we train ourselves in meditation to stay in relaxed contact with our experience. So when the bell goes, we learn to pause and find stability with more and more skill and speed. And so Dean told me, I use the mindfulness bell when I'm practicing meditation in the morning or if I'm on retreat. However, when I'm in meetings with civil servants, I can't really take my bell in because they'll think I'm a bit weird. So I use other things to be my mindfulness bell. I'll ensure I have a glass of water in front of me. Then, if irritation or anger or a closed mind comes up in me, and they often do, then just by reaching out and touching the glass and bringing it to my mouth and sipping, it brings me back to my body and brings me back to my breath and it brings me back to my equanimity. This is very wise. And another thing that really struck me in my conversation with Dean was his saying that passion isn't enough. Passion isn't enough, skill isn't enough, intellect isn't enough. You need wisdom and compassion as well in order to take useful action and in order not to get overwhelmed or burned out. And this is also linked with, the other of these change makers, for instance, Dr. Ariaratne talking about the need for a focus on interdependence and compassion in order to have wisdom to make good choices. So Dean says, I think having passion about injustice is one thing, but I don't believe that passion and skill and intellect are enough. There has to be compassion in your heart and understanding the nature of interbeing, that everything is everything else, to affect change in a sustainable way. We have to do it with deep looking. When I've contemplated things on a wider scale, there's a recognition that my heart must have a massive amount of equanimity, love, and compassion. And understanding alongside the skills and expertise that I've gained over the years, and the passion that I still have in my body to affect change. You can't do it on passion alone. So, those are the stories. And I'm really interested to know from you what inspired you, what has caught your attention. And what might you like to learn more about or even try out in your lives? I'm going to put those questions in the chat. Someone says, I would really love it if you wrote a book. The interesting thing is, I would like to write a book as well, but there's two or three books that already exist, which are basically the book that I would write that talk about Dharma with loads of examples. And I'm going to be sharing more about some of these resources that are already out there, on my wherever I put my writing, which will probably be my website and Instagram and so on, which I'm going to put in the chat again. So do connect with me because I want to be writing more and thinking more about these things and having more dialogue with people. I plan to build a big map of all of these contemplative change makers and how they link with each other. And while I'm doing marketing, I think Marnie has already mentioned there's going to be a course. I'm going to do a course next month on these topics, but particularly on upekkha, on equanimity, even-mindedness in the context of challenges and in the context of disagreement. So that's not a very good marketing message I've just put in the chat, but that's just there so you can look it up. And please come along. Please connect with me. Please come along. Right. You are welcome to ask any questions, and I will also look back. Caroline says, feel uncomfortable with the conflation of learning difficulties and autism. Yeah, I hear that. I mean, it is the on the front page of their website, it's the way they set it up. So I'm reporting the story, but I understand and I see that. Still trying to learn the connection between the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. Can I explain further? I didn't. That is a good question. I will very briefly say the Four Noble Truths are a kind of statement, a kind of creation of a frame of reference that there is suffering, there's a way to suffering, there's an end to suffering, and there's a way to the end of suffering. Then the Eightfold Path is like how to do the fourth one. The way to the end of suffering is following the Eightfold Path. That's a very, very short version. I hope that's helpful. Quickest Dharma lesson in the world. I am going to look back at the rest of the chat. And if you would like to, put your hand up and ask a question verbally, that is wonderful as well, because then it's not just my voice in the room. Even better. Sandy says, can you speak about living with the personal fear that must come with activism? That's an interesting one. Sandy, I wonder if you would say a little bit more, either in the chat or feel free to come on screen. Just because it's always easier to see fear of retaliation. Could you say in what context? Do you mean like on the street? Or in what context? Sorry to put you on the spot. It's just hard to respond to general questions sometimes. Lee says, I always thought the people who do actions, etc., were mostly middle or upper class. Yes, true. Do you get working class people joining you too? A broad range of people? Yes. Sandy, I see your response and I will respond to it. Lee, yes. There is an organization called the Working Class Climate Alliance here in the UK, and there's a really interesting woman, Lucy. I can't remember her second name suddenly, but it's really worth looking up. So it's a massive problem. There's also an organization called GND Media, who do an excellent podcast on this a lot, on these topics a lot, and they are working class journalists. But you're dead right. activists, street, those kinds of climate activists are very often middle class. Okay, so I'm gonna try to respond to Sandy's question, but I'm also really encourage other people in the US who may have a sense, a greater sense than me to respond, because it's not as bad here yet. So I can't speak really from direct experience. I guess I can just make a very general response, and you can tell me what you think, which is to work with, to treat the fear, like not in the situation, but maybe while you're in a safe place, to treat the fear as part of your experience, and to really listen to it, and to really understand what your boundaries are. Because I think the way the government in the US is behaving is so different to our norms that we've lived with for like so many years. And I think it is really scary. And maybe just acknowledging that is the place to start. That it is totally rational to be frightened of their behavior towards activists, and to go f and to work with others to talk about what levels of risk feel appropriate and ways you can protect each other. But yeah, not to pretend it's not there. I'm sorry, I don't have anything more useful to say. But I really welcome anyone else who can. Say something from more experience. I tend to listen to my fear and not take very many risks. Certainly not at this point in my life. I do what I can. I was involved in an action a few years ago, and there was, people very keen to take to do some very particularly risky things, and I did speak up and say I'm not really okay with that, and I'll be off if that's what you're gonna do. And it turned out that actually lots of other people were also feeling really freaked out by the suggestion, but for whatever reason they hadn't said. And it turned out we changed the strategy, and I decided to stay in the group as a result. So that's just one tiny example, but it's really, really hard. What I can see in the US is like is it is frightening, and it's totally okay to be frightened. And Caroline says our government is breaching norms, just not as obviously. Carol says, how to bring in meditation to protests already established? Just do it. Just go and sit down. Just start. Other meditators will find you. And yeah, there's no other way. There's the rolling picket starting tomorrow, actually, outside the Department for Energy and Net Zero in London. Between 8 and 9 a.m. against the Rosebank oil field. And I'm thinking of going along later in the week to, and I will probably just sit. I'll take my bench and just sit down. So come along, we can do it together. Lee says, I was going to volunteer with XR, etc., but I was worried that putting it on my CV would give me issues. Don't put it on your CV. Just do it. Just don't put it on your CV. Surely. Okay. And then Elizabeth says, looking into investments, ESG funds. Any thoughts on this? I mean, it's better than nothing. I don't think it's the answer for sure. I don't know what the answer is. I'm quite suspicious of ESG. But it's a balance. Sorry, that's such an anodyne answer. But there are lots of resources out there. There's ethical financial advice out there, so I guess look into it. I think probably the Quakers have some pretty good resources on this and might be worth looking at. And I will now start to wrap up because we have just a couple of minutes left. So just to remind you, please get in touch with me. Please stay in touch with me. Please come. If you're in London, come to a group. I'm trying to form some community around this. And I really welcome people because that's what community is. If you're in London and you can come, all the information's on my website. Please come along to a course next month on Sangha Live. Please connect with each other. Please connect with the people around you and your existing Sanghas on these issues. And if you're able to give dana for this session, that helps me to do more of this stuff. I do have other sources of income. I work with groups and organizations as a consultant. I get paid to do that. And I'd love to do more of this. So if I get paid for it, I can shift more of my time. So take that as you will. I welcome your generosity. And I'll see if Marnie has anything else to say or share.
What we can do is, I think because you all registered, we have an email list. So for those of you who are interested, we'll probably just email everybody who registered for today about your course, your series. It's a two-part series, guys. It's 90 minutes, two parts. The date off the top of my head, I was just trying to remember. It was the 23rd of November, 16th of November, I think, and the 23rd.
I think that's
And,
right. It's Sundays. It's two Sunday afternoons in a row.
so if this interests you and you want more support and to look at how to be engaged and have equanimity in a whole new way that brings meaning and life to the experience of what it is to hold and embody that, if I got you right, Mila, that we will email you and let you know about how to register for that two-part series.